Hello, and welcome to Mangasplaining, the show where we recommend great manga to folks who haven't read much manga before. Hosted by Deb Aoki, David Brothers, Chip Zdarsky, and myself, Christopher Butcher, you can follow along with our show notes and reading list and much, much more at mangasplaining.com. So as I mentioned in the intro, my name is Christopher Butcher, and this week our book is one that we actually had suggested a lot when we started the podcast. It is called An Invitation from a Crab by an author named Panpanya. Panpanya is referred to as in gender-neutral pronouns by the publisher. However, they are self-referred to themselves as he, but I think it's sort of flexible. So we're going to use a variety of pronouns on this episode, trying to respect how everyone refers to this author. So, you know, if we end up being disrespectful, I apologize in advance. Panpanya's Invitation from a Crab is a really interesting book, and it's one I wanted to do because it's very different than anything we've done so far on the podcast. Panpanya sort of rose to fame by being a self-publisher, by making doujinshi, going to Comedia, the doujinshi festival that is for people that make sort of original series, original ideas, rather than parodies or things like that. And their work was particularly notable because they liked to do really sort of artsy stuff. And, you know, you say that to a North American audience and you think, that doesn't mean anything, but the doujinshi scene in Japan tends to be pretty codified. There are numerous doujinshi printers in Japan that you send them files and they will pump out a beautiful, perfect-looking, bound 32 or 48 or 64-page book. They'll deliver it right to your table at the show. So most of the time when independent publishers or doujinshi artists, manga artists, make a new doujinshi, they see it for the first time sitting at their table at the show that they're about to sell it at, which, as anyone who's ever made a comic for a show knows, is terrifying. Like, oh my God, I hope it turned out because I ordered 5,000 of these and I'm supposed to sell them in the next 6 hours. But that's the way it goes. Panpanya, on the other hand, is known for doing things like hand binding their doujinshi, doing hardcover editions, doing individual remarking, which is to say getting a printed edition and then like coloring in the cover by hand and selling it that way. All kinds of really interesting stuff. Their book here, An Invitation from a Crab, is their second collection of work. And we also did something a little special this episode where I interviewed the translator, Ko Ransom, and that's going to show up as a segment at about the 45-minute mark. Jump ahead or look in the show notes to see when it actually is if you want to hear the
Jump ahead.
And then come back to the beginning. We got to get those listener counts up. Like, listen to this episode 3-4 times, maybe. But yeah, I'm gonna stop talking about the background and talk about this book. I just checked and I was going to like explain the book by reading the back of the book because we've been doing that lately. Back of the book offers no information. It's just like Panpanya is really interesting and they won an award. Also, here's the dictionary definition of what a crab is. And it's like, that does not help. That does not help you as a listener know about this book. So let me instead say that Invitation from a Crab is a collection of short stories, some of them original to this book, some of them that were serialized online, and some collecting doujinshi work. They are poetic, they are artistic, sometimes they're jokes, sometimes they're true stories, and sometimes they have the sheen of true stories, but are the furthest thing from it. It's a really interesting book, and I think for folks that have a sort of regular manga, a type, let's say, I think that reading something like An Invitation from a Crab will show you that there's a lot more to manga than maybe you've been reading. So I want to go around and we're going to do classic asking people what they thought this time. And I'm going to start alphabetically with Deb Aoki and ask Deb, what did you think of An Invitation from a Crab by Panpanya?
I mean, I had heard of this book for a while, but I had not picked it up until you picked it. Mm. I had no idea what it was about. I had no idea that it was short stories. I thought, well, it looks interesting. The art's very, very unusual. Yeah, it is very indie. it's quirky. It kind of reminded me a little bit of, and this is going to sound really weird, it reminded me both of Shigeru Mizuki in that Shigeru Mizuki draws very cartoony characters with very detailed backgrounds. And it reminded me of Yoshiharu Suge. Mm. And kind of like Screw Style. Like a lot of this, a lot of this feels like in Screw Style, where there's an everyman who goes through a series of surreal events and then just kind of has to like figure out, what's going on here? Am I okay? What's, you know, I don't understand. And then it's never quite a horror book, you know, But there's always a sense of wonder and feeling perplexed about things.
Mm.
Yeah, it's just, it's whimsical, but yet not super sweet.
Mm.
The character looks like a girl, but might be a boy. And then there's this repeating characters, like this thing with this bulb on its head. A lot of it I was just reading, going like, I'm not sure what's going on here, but I'm just going to roll with it. Does that make sense?
It does, actually. I didn't want to interrupt because I think you touched on a couple of things that it's going to be fun when everyone listens to this and then listens to the interview as well, because it's rare that we actually get a, yes, this person was definitely influenced by this out of this episode or any of these episodes of Manga Explaining. So Ko has some insight that I think is really good. Yeah, I think it is definitely whimsical, and maybe more than whimsical, I found it very unsettling a lot of the time. It's that, has everyone seen Spirited Away, the Ghibli film, the Miyazaki film?
Nope.
All right.
So that should be good for Chip too.
Okay.
Yeah, there you go. Yep. Talking to Deb and David, the first time I saw Spirited Away, it was like a genuine sense of fear for the lead character, because they're entering this other world where everything has the sheen of being understandable, but nothing is exactly the way that she thinks it should be or thinks that it, you know, would be. And so she's constantly like at a disadvantage. She's like perplexed and, you know, like these things that like, oh, I'm going to a bathhouse. That's a thing I've done probably, you know, 100 times at this point, but it's wrong. Like everything's just a little bit off and a little bit wrong. And that's very much the feeling I got. So yeah, Deb, I agree with you there. David, what was your first impression of An Invitation from a Crab?
So I trust your taste, and I trust Ed Chavez, the top dog at Dinfa Publishing, formerly of Vertical. And so I was really surprised when halfway through, I was like, man, I am like really bouncing off of this one. It's not clicking. Mm-hmm. Like I kind of got it, like the simple character art versus like the more, not realistic, but modeled on real life. Environmental art, you know? And I think it wasn't until I had to pull up the table of contents, which uses Roman numerals for some reason. The giant salamander was where it started coming around for me. And then the one where they build the model pickled radish maker.
Oh, yeah, that was cute.
And then The Perfect Sunday, I thought was a really good, like, single chapter.
Mm-hmm.
And it's weird because this is sort of a more... This was good. Like, I liked it. I like that it was kind of challenging, even if it didn't completely land with me. But it's sort of a more sedate or serious type of story than something like Keiichi Arawi's City would be, even though you could describe them in very similar ways. Like, young girl goes to city, strange things happen, she rolls with it, and then there's like a twist ending that's like a vicious anticlimax. Like, yeah. That happens in both books. But the difference between this and City is that City's almost pathologically slapstick.
Yeah.
Like every second page, every third panel is a joke. While this is sort of kind of built to maybe a joke, maybe not. Maybe it's going to be heartfelt. Maybe it's just going to be like, it's over. Like, this is where the story stops. So it was really interesting. And like Deb, I didn't know anything about it going in outside of, you know, who recommended it. I generally like, you know, Ko Ransom's translations and things like that. But there were fewer crabs than I expected.
I do not recommend this book if you're into crabs.
Lots of crab symbols, you know, the logo and all that. But yeah, I think I was expecting something like maybe more of like a YA Spirited Away type story. Mm. I think there are elements of that. Like All the Crying People was like a super effective, like, creepy thing with a really dumb punchline to kind of, you know, back it up, which I thought was really good, you know, really good writing. But it's not quite my type of humor, and it's not quite poignant enough to be like my type of, like, this is where I go to, like, have my heart to read heartfelt things.
I didn't find it heartfelt,
really.
Yeah, I felt like it was more on that in a sec. I'll let you finish your thought.
I forgot where I was going with it.
Oh shit, I'm so sorry.
Going Chris. God.
But I was going to say, I liked reading this in part because I think it's good comics, like good comics making interesting drawings and things like that. But also I knew we were going to talk about it. And a lot of the fun for comics for me even, especially if I don't understand them or there's something I don't quite get about them, is seeing what other people think. Mm. So no pressure. Yeah.
I do want to comment on the one thing, and that is mm-hmm. that I don't feel it is heartfelt, and I feel like it is disassociative in a very contemporary way. The first story starts off and it has these like sort of lush, overly hatched, like tiny, tiny hatches all over the page, backgrounds and other characters and things like that. But the lead, the Pompania stand-in character, is drawn roughly in like pencil and an unsharpened pencil at that. They mm-hmm. seem much more hollow and unreal and ghost-like than everything else that's going on. They seem like they're kind of floating through this story in particular, but really all of the stories. These are things that happen to them. And then you also think of like, oh, you're actually viewing these through this author's point of view. And that's why maybe everything seems a little strange and a little disassociated. And I feel like it's alienated. It's not alienating. Well, I mean, it might. We haven't gotten to Chip yet, but it's definitely alienated. It's definitely, it feels like maybe they're grasping for emotion or feeling or something out of these stories, but A, life doesn't really provide that, and B, maybe they don't know how. I get a real sense of being disconnected from everything in this world, and it and like the characters are, not just myself, but the characters. But yeah.
Interesting. I actually feel the opposite of you.
Really?
On several of those points. Yeah. I feel like it's super heartfelt. Like she's always trying to help somebody, or like the whole salamander thing, where they get on a boat and go to the Amazon from Japan.
Mm.
Feels like such a like kind, cartoonishly kind thing to do.
Yeah.
But it's also a tiny thing in the context of this book, because they get on a boat that just says boat and then they're there.
Yeah.
like it's funny. Yeah. That's the disconnect here. And like, I think a lot of it is revealed in the text pieces in between, where it's just like, this is kind of observational. Everything's observational, even if, you know, there is a character going through these things. There's that kind of detachment to it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Even that salamander story. Yeah. It's like that, like the Pompania character taking the salamander back to the Amazon is something that happens to them almost. Like, it's like, all right, we're giving you the salamander. All right. You've got to get it home. And like, they're with someone else who's driving the story, because it seems like they're incapable. Like, they can't even quit their terrible job in the one where they are forced to quit their terrible job. And saying I'm not going to bicycle for a living is like about the strongest decision that they make in the whole book. But anyway,
also everything is futile. Like almost every story is about futility, because the salamander wasn't even supposed to go there.
Yeah.
You know, it's like she creates this Rube Goldberg machine and it turns out, oh, it's actually Sunday. Like,
yeah.
Like the stories all seem to have that kind of beat to them.
Yeah. Like someone who's out of step with reality.
Mm-hmm.
But, and like Sen in Spirited Away, someone who's just like completely out of step by the end, like so out of step at the beginning of Spirited Away that she literally turns into like a phantom until she eats some of their food and is like grounded and stops floating away. So I think that there's something, that's the vibe I got. But sorry, we've started talking about this book in earnest without finding out what our good friend Chip Zdarsky actually thinks of it. Chip, what did you think?
No, good friend.
Good friend.
I thought it was delightful.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. It felt like a kind of a breath of fresh air after seeing maybe, you know, one or two too many kind of repetitive styles. Maybe it's because I'm wistful for late 90s, early 2000s independent press SPX comics. I just kept going, oh, that background's very Jeffrey Brown.
Yeah.
You know? But I thought all the stories were like engaging, interesting. I never quite knew where they were going. And funny, I realized afterwards, one of my markers for if I really enjoyed a book or really didn't enjoy a book is how many screen grabs I do of the pages as I go.
Mm.
Like, I'm like, oh, I got to remember this. Oh, I got to remember this. And this probably broke the record for that.
Wow.
Because
there were so many pages which just like a fun sketchbook style drawing, or just like a really kind of a humorous panel or exchange. Mm-hmm. And I just kept like gravitating towards those.
Mm.
Something as simple as just like the page of her smacking the coconuts open.
Yeah.
It's just, it's so charming. And it's so funny. Just the sound effect and everything just plucks. She's got this tiny stick and just cracking open coconuts.
The sound effects were really pleasant too.
Yeah.
And the subtitled sound effects too. I think they did a good job of like matching for the most part.
It really, you know, jived with the vibe of it for sure.
Yeah.
But yeah. And there were a lot of like, I keep thinking of sketchbook drawings because this feels like I've come across somebody's sketchbook. Just kind of like really detailed but rough and not quite getting the perspective of a thing, but really getting the feel of a thing.
Mm-hmm.
There's some beautiful panels and pages in this.
Page 192 had one that I liked a lot.
Which one was that?
It was her. It was in the one where she sees all the kites while she's walking around, and she's kind of walking towards the camera while there's like these kind of slightly crooked houses on her on our left. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just a really nice perspective drawing of being in a neighborhood.
Okay. Yeah. There was one of her, I forget which story it was, I just have the screen grab, where she's walking and she's going to go through transit gates, and it's the panels from below, and it's just so foreboding. Even though it's something so mundane. Like, that's the thing, like, the artist is clearly good at kind of taking mundane things and making them really interesting just with the style. And, you know, I've said it before in previous episodes that you can tell when somebody enjoys the act of drawing.
Mm-hmm.
And this person enjoys the act of drawing. You know, and it's deceptively simple in spots, or it feels rushed or whatever. But I don't think that's the case. I think it's just like, oh, no, that's the drawing. That's how the drawing should be.
Mm.
Yeah, and I found it really fascinating. And there was so many just... yeah, humorous, low-key moments that made me laugh.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I found it to be delightful. It's funny, though, the one story that I just kind of bounced off of, which was the first one.
Yeah.
Like, that was it. That was the one where I was just like, oh, is this book going to be all this? And then it wasn't. Mm. And then there's a lot more kind of humor throughout and interesting scenarios.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I actually got to be honest. I was closer to David when I read this the first time. I'm a lot closer, actually. I got about halfway through and I was like, oh, I feel like this is really pretentious, actually. I am bouncing off of this super hard. And it doesn't help. Reminded me a little bit of the of bouncing off of parts of St. Young Men. In between each story, especially at the beginning, there's what look like, honestly, small blog entries that are like, here's a thought I had. And it's like, just, it's always just on the verge of being profound, but it never is. And it's just like these text pieces build a picture of the author, I think, but they don't necessarily do the collection of stories that the author is telling any favors. And I didn't like them. And actually, by the time I got to the end, I didn't like them. But I think it was halfway. I thought the joke of Pampanya's character inventing themselves out of a job was actually kind of good. And it wasn't until about halfway through that I realized that, like, no, there's supposed to be jokes in this. Like, you're just not laughing because whatever, you're just not in that, like, you're not in that space.
Yeah, you're dead inside.
Yeah, maybe. It's been a rough couple of years.
The dolphin calculator alone.
Yeah.
The dolphin
calculator. That was good. I like that one.
Like, this feels so liquid television.
Such a well-drawn thing as well.
Yeah.
Like looking at every drawing of that dolphin made me laugh.
The one that made me sit up and pay attention was the story where they go to Ginza for the pineapples.
Oh, yeah.
And they get out of the train station in Ginza, and it's literally Ginza, but like not Ginza. It's sort of like how Treasure Town and Tekkon Kinkrete.
Yeah, that's what I thought
Osaka,
too.
But not Osaka. And it's just like, oh, yeah, that one building is right, but that other giant, like, 10-pointed star is not correct. Anyway, or maybe it was in the past. Like, yeah, that illustration and the illustrations, like the foreboding illustrations of like the characters in pencil again, of people seeming less real than objects in the world, I think is really where I start. Was like, okay, there's definitely other stuff going on here too. And it wasn't the first story I think I was like, oh, I actually like that. Like this is I got off at the wrong station.
Oh yeah, wandering. Yeah.
Wandering. Yeah, which is again that title just puts my teeth on edge.
that's interesting. Like, how does that get translated?
I'm sure poetically. Like, I feel like there's a lot of poetry to this, and you either get on their level and you get with their vibe, or you don't. And I think that Poe is like 1,000% on the vibe of this. Like this feels the translator on this one feels invisible to me. I don't feel anything that is like additive like I do sometimes with other things.
Yeah, nothing feels like writing.
If you look at like page 88, where's that scene where she's in on the street and she's like, "Where am I?" The signs are translated too, where it says, "No way home. Where is this? Stranded here."
Is wondering also the one with the panel, and that dog is on a walk by itself?
That's also good.
Which is so funny because it's not.
I think that
just...
was her lucky day one.
That was her lucky day.
Yeah. That made me laugh so much because it's just like that's not the observation here. The observation is the fact that the dog is walking like a human.
Yeah,
like it's just like just casually strolling on a walk by itself. Like, it's so
Chris,
funny.
Could you repeat one thing from earlier? Like, or actually, could you describe the relation of how the main character is drawn versus the rest of the book again? Because I have a question related to it.
So, in the beginning, especially, the main character is drawn. It looks like in pencil, like a rough pencil, and then either composited onto the page, but I don't think that's the case. I think it's actually, but they're drawn into a very scratchy ink background that looks like it's both brush and pen. Mm-hmm. So it's like a really, like the backgrounds have a weight, have a gravity to them, where the characters feel very ethereal in contrast to me. I'm looking at, I got off the wrong station, the Wandering story. And in this one, in addition to the pencil lines, the lead character is wearing a sweater that's all done with tone. So it's like pencils, tone, and then surrounded by these heavy inks. And somehow the tone even makes them feel kind of lighter. They're doing really interesting stuff with art here. But what did you want to ask about that?
Because I think partly why we see it differently or why I feel like we're at opposites on this is that I just took that as a style rather than a storytelling choice. So something like Goodnight Poon Poon, for instance, you know, Poon Poon and his family are drawn in very simplistic, like cartoon bird people style in a very realistic world. Like that was for storytelling. Like it was saying something about the character, but here it's almost more, they're drawn that way. Several other characters are drawn that way. I think that's just how Panpanya approached characters. Cause then there's also the Tanuki later, the, weird thing she hangs out with in the wandering section. So I think for me, rather than seeing pretension, I saw almost not the opposite, but more of a, this is definitely very artful and RT. Like I would totally buy this at Ape or something, you know?
Yeah.
But it's, they worked out the pretension in their work.
It's
earlier.
It's inconsistent too, because in the Salamander story, everyone's drawn in ink, but it looks like that's actually drawn in a different way. But the when it became sort of clearer to me what was like what I felt was going on was the pineapple story, the Ginza story. Because in that one, Panpanya is still drawn in pencil. The lead, the insert character is still drawn in pencil. But when they meet the pineapple farmer, they're drawn in ink. So it actually creates a contrast. Like there's definitely an otherness between how they see themselves and their friend who's with them and how they see this other person. Like they've drawn themselves completely differently. I'm trying to find a good page for you here, but it's tough because, well, we're scrolling.
I'd say page 69. There's like
nice.
The lower left panel has the main character and also the pineapple monger, I guess.
Yeah. And like the pineapple person, pineapple monger, the pineapple farmer is drawn in like drawn as a part of the environment. Well, they're drawn as a part of their environment, whereas like even in the panel above that on page 69, the boat is drawn like a squiggle, but the waves are given life and like the things that the author chooses to imbue with, like it didn't seem deliberate at first. It seemed like, oh, look at me, I'm ethereal, I'm floating through life, and then there's all these like weird situations and I'm set apart from them and I don't understand. But it grew into something that seemed a lot more real as the story went on. But I'd actually wanted to like take a step back just for a sec and ask, because I know this isn't going to be everyone's cup of tea. I think we're all coming at it from very different places. What was the story that you liked the best out of this short story collection? And I'll give you guys a second to think. But for me, I think it was the Got Off at the Wrong Train Station one, because it has the most interesting drawing to me. It has the platform gates drawn with like a reverse fisheye thing going on that Chip mentioned. It has the shopping arcade that's drawn with like, it looks like it's being sort of blown out from inside. And it's got these sort of like everyday Japanese landmarks that are just treated in really different ways artistically as like the world gets more difficult to, for the lead character to understand. And I thought that that was actually like, that was where I was like, oh, this art is like actually really maybe very good. So that was the story that I really liked. Wondering.
It's hard for me to choose. I hadn't thought of it before, but as you were talking about the pineapple story, I was like, oh, I really like that pineapple story. Just the idea of like trying to piece together what a pineapple is in a country where they're not, you know, they're not grown.
It made me doubt like my knowledge of pineapples.
Yeah, same here. And the idea that like, you know, the pineapple monger or whatever, great Marvel villain, by the way, pineapple monger, just like stuffing like pineapple cubes into like pineapple purses, and that's what they are telling people a pineapple is. Just such a funny, ludicrous idea. I really, really, really like that one. But it was mostly just about the moments. Like, there's so many like great moments in this. I also like the character that just like paints the duck decoys every day. Like, it's just such a crazy idea. And then when they have the panel where the main character is kind of looking around at all the paintings on the wall, and they're just like basically the same thing with every once in a while there's an extra duck. And the futility of art is like, have you gotten any better at this? And, well, I'm getting better at drawing the water surface a little bit. Like, I don't know, it really hit me hard as an artist. But yeah, like the one that made me laugh, like chuckle the most was definitely the dolphin calculator. I really, really, really like that one.
That's such an Adult Swim joke to me. Like, just something about it.
Yeah.
Like, it's Aqua Teen Hunger Force to a T.
But it's such a, it's a gentle joke as well. Like, taking care of this thing, and then it kind of helps out here and there, and next thing you know, it's graduated university. Like,
the book cover killed me in that one.
Yeah. So much of it. So funny.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Dev David, did you guys have a favorite story, or is this more of a collection of moments, but not favorite quality, or favorite times?
I mean, there are things I definitely related to, like the part where she's trying to make this perfect Sunday, and she's in denial at all the signs that tell her that it's really not Saturday, it's Sunday.
Yeah.
I felt that many times. Like, oh, and then it's like, oh, but no, but Monday's a holiday. Yay, all of a sudden you're happy. I think the dolphin one is probably maybe the funniest one, especially the ending where it's like, it says, oh, here's the math book I wrote. And she says, what's a function? And he goes, it's a math thing.
Yeah.
Oh, God. See, now you got me thinking about that weekend one again. Maybe that's my favorite.
But I mean, Wandering is probably the most artistically interesting one, because it does create a lot of, one, it creates a sense of a nightmare of unreality. Yeah. And a little bit of, I mean, there's parts of Japan that you can feel this energy, right? This slight Showa era decrepitude.
Yeah.
Decrepitude. Nice word.
Or things are just kind of like not tourism worthy. It's just kind of like dusty and worn out and just kind of old. But at the same time, what comes through a lot is like in Tokyo, where you are very, very rarely alone. It's a very large and crowded city. It's just a little bit odd to come across it must feel really disquieting to all of a sudden be in this feeling where I don't know where this is. I am all alone. I don't know which end is up. Am I in danger? And Tokyo, one reason why I like traveling around Japan is, as a woman, I feel completely safe. No matter how lost I am, I feel completely safe. But this is interesting because this kind of felt more like when I felt lost in India, where it's like, I'm screwed.
It's different when you don't know how to get around and you don't know what the local anything is, and it seems like things don't make sense. Like, I get that, and that it was a very, like, it was unsettling, I think is that one for sure.
Yeah. I've had that feeling when, like, I've gone to, like, outside of Tokyo, like, catching, like, I went up to Nagano, and went on this off-the-beaten-path hike trip, and there was, like, these moments where you feel like, I'm going to miss my stop. Or where am I? This is in the middle of nowhere. I think we there was a little bit of that feeling. We went to the sake brewery.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Where we were just like this, getting in some stranger's car who was going to drive us to where we were supposed to go.
It was like this like train station in the middle of nowhere. It's like completely abandoned. And you're like, well, yeah. I don't know where we are.
Yeah, so we're going to go to this train station at this time. And we've never been there. And we're going to walk for 15 minutes from the train station to an intersection. There should be a restaurant there. And someone should meet us there to pick us up by car and drive us like an hour into the countryside. And you're just like, okay. Well, I was just like, I'm putting all my faith in Deb on this one because Deb knows how to plan these things. I didn't even occur to me that you might be like, oh my God, this is terrifying. But yeah, it was, I was just like, no, Deb knows what's going on. It's fine. Don't worry about it.
I'm glad I hide it well.
And Deb's like, Chris knows what's going on. He's fine.
Yeah, no, I was.
I did want to tell you a little story though. Oh. I did meet Pampanya.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
At Comedia.
No, my friend Simona Stanziani, she's a translator. She translates Japanese to Italian.
Mm-hmm.
She called me up when I was in Japan last week. She says, hey, you want to come to this manga party? And I go, manga party? And it was basically the year-end party for Hakusensha. So it was like at this hotel and then at this fancy buffet. And it was like all the artists and editors from Young Animal, Hana Toyume. And, you know, it was just a weird mix because, like, you get the people who published Berserk and the people who published Fruit Basket.
I was going to say Young Animal and Hana Toyume seem like opposites.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, it was a very weird room because, like, half of it was the guys and more than half of it was the girls. And then I was like, we're mingling around. And then she says, oh, this guy's a manga artist. I go, oh, dude, no kidding. He goes, yeah, Pampanya. It's like, I know you. I know your work. But I had not read his work before, so I couldn't say, I love your work. I just said, I just know your work. But he looks nothing like the character.
I'm so glad you didn't like pretend to know the work and be like, oh, I love your book all about crabs.
And then that would have made it into a story, right? Like, there was this weird Japanese girl who couldn't speak any Japanese, was just rambling at me.
Just obsessed with crabs.
Yeah.
I think it's not my favorite, but the reason why I thought this was a heartfelt book was Incomprehensible Memories, where she's remembering all the weird gifts her grandmother gave her. And then she's like, you know, I wonder one day will I be able to understand these toys and this letter? And it's like, oh, this is like one of those books, you know?
Yeah.
But I think my actual favorite was definitely The Perfect Sunday. Because so much of it was just a really good series of drawings of being outside. Others were like good jokes, like the Rube Goldberg thing. I love every time that type of thing happens.
Yeah.
And like her industriousness and getting it done. And just the sheer, like, maniacal focus on making a good Sunday to the point where she's, like, denying Saturday.
Yeah.
It's like, I'm going to, like, do this now, but I'll save the emotions for tomorrow. I don't know. Like, this was funny and heartfelt and just really well-drawn and good. Like, well-written, I suppose.
Yeah, and it's, like, not that it has a deeper message, but it's, like, you know, it's definitely a live in the moment kind of story. Like,
yeah, exactly.
You can plan and you can like work at a thing, but also just like, well, don't deny yourself what's happening right now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like Chris mentioned really being on the same wavelength as the book. And I think this is the chapter that was the most on my like personal wavelength.
I'm actually more looking forward to the second book of his that's coming out.
Oh, what's the second book?
Gayabano Holiday.
Oh, sorry. Can you say it again?
Gayabano Holiday. It's you know, kind of like the pineapple one, right? But it's like he finds this weird fruit in Ameyokucho. He gets this can of juice, Gayabano juice. And then he decides to find out what does this fruit look like. And then he ends up going on a trip to the Philippines.
I love it.
So I'm all about travel manga. So I want to check this out.
Wow. That's awesome.
That's technically a food manga too, I think.
I think so.
There you go. And that's coming out in December, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is it the same publisher?
Yep.
Denpa Publishing. Everyone put your pre-orders in right now.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know that actually when I was interviewing Ko and he mentioned, and yeah, the new one's coming up. And I was just like, what? I just picked this because I wanted to pick it. I had no idea. But yeah. Isn't it nice when we get to actually promote a future release instead of just talking about one that's 3 years old? I'm sure Ed somewhere is like less annoyed with me now for constantly picking his old books to talk about.
Does he grouse about that?
One of the things he said on Twitter, and it might have been between Vertical and when Denpo was publishing, and it's always really stuck with me as someone who talks about manga, writes about manga, is so much of the future of a manga is decided in its first, like, in the 3 months before it comes out and the 3 months after it comes out, because pre-orders set the print run in a lot of cases. Like, things get listed on Amazon like 6 months out, that sort of thing. So if the pre-orders are high, the print run is higher. And if the print run is higher, it makes more money because it's cheaper to print a book if you print more of that book. So the balance sheet looks really good. If you pre-order a book and the pre-orders are high and then it sells out, there's a greater chance it'll get a second printing or a third printing or a fourth printing. But if something doesn't have a lot of buzz before it comes out and you're like really, you discover it and you're really excited about it, and then you do a podcast about Helter Skelter 8 years after it came out, that doesn't help. It doesn't help anybody. Like, that book is already out of print now, and like, we didn't get any more Kyoko Okazaki after that in pink, and it was a bummer. And we might at some point in the future. But yeah, he was just like, talk about the books when they're coming, like as they come out or just before. Try to pre-order if you can afford it. Like, that kind of thing is super important to, and not for everything. Like, obviously Shonen Jump's going to come out tomorrow. As long as the sun rises, there'll be another Shonen Jump. Like, no offense, but like, it's not, no one's stopping that. But these edge cases, these like indie manga from smaller publishers, both smaller publishers in Japan and in North America, I think anything you can do to support them, if it's something that you, if you want to support, is really huge. Like, really, really huge, actually. Shout out to small pubs.
I do like that you created our new tagline for Mangasplaining. Mangasplaining. It doesn't help anyone.
No, only the 8-year-old books don't help anyone. Yeah. We were a part of the wave the house husband wave. We were a part of that. So that was really good. Yeah, let's maybe get a few final thoughts. David, I actually am maybe more convinced by your reading than mine as we end here. I do feel that the author still feels very disconnected from Japanese society, from the society in which they live. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I feel like they're trying to make a connection. Like, there are these heartfelt moments that are really real and not pointless, like Chip pointed out.
There so, is yeah, I think a, maybe just an a essay called futile. Disconnect.
Yeah. So yeah, I think you've convinced me to a degree. Did you have any final thoughts on the book?
Yeah, even though this wasn't 100%, like, I wasn't all in on this one, it was definitely the kind of book that convinces me to get the next book that this author is going to do.
Yeah.
And really, like, if you like this, I really have to recommend Araoi's City, which is kind of this in, I don't know, like 120x fast forward.
All right.
Yeah.
You've mentioned that a couple times. I'm surprised you haven't recommended it yet, to be honest.
I like it too much. And explaining jokes is never fun.
fair enough.
Oh, give us some credit. We'll get the jokes, don't you think?
Y'all are going to regret this so much when I assign 12 volumes for the podcast.
No.
So this was supposed to be funny, David?
Deb, any final thoughts?
I mean, I'm glad I got to read it. I think indie manga doesn't really get a lot of play, and it's nice to see that it's out there.
Mm-hmm.
It's very quirky.
Mm.
I feel like too, like what Dave was saying is like, if you like this but you want something a little bit more funny than Yugo City, I would say if you like this but you want it to be more dark and serious, go read Tsuge. Drawn Quarterly has like 2 or 3 volumes, and they're going to publish all of Yoshiharu Tsuge's work over the next couple of years. He's a really fascinating creator and captures kind of some of that alienation and of old Japan, as well as just these really haunting and disturbing stories that are just about, and not disturbing in the way that it's horrific, but disturbing in the way that what it reveals about the human condition. I think Panpanya's work will make sense more if you read Tsuge's work, because he's kind of like the godfather of all this stuff. But you know, this is fun.
Yeah.
Chipper, any final thoughts?
I really love it. I thought it was delightful and multi-layered and fun and well drawn, and yeah, it's great. I do genuinely feel like if you have a love of kind of like North American indie comic scene stuff, that you should check this out.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
My final thought is that the drawing of the carp streamers on page 142 has stayed with me now for weeks after reading this book. Can't get that image out of my head. It's not even like technically the best drawing in the book, but it's really, really good in the context of this like scary ghost type story. Carp streamers. I'll put it in the show notes.
And that that look on her face right below it is very
so good.
Scary.
So good.
The sketchy sweating.
Yeah.
Yeah. Love that
effect. There's something on every page that's interesting. Like in terms of the types of drawing, the style, panels, like objects, like this is well worth a read, I think.
Actually, the punchline to that story was really good too. Like the final panel where it's like the mountain pass never existed or whatever.
Yeah, the village never existed on the mountain pass.
Yeah.
Dun dun dun. It was a good one. This has been An Invitation from a Crab by Panpanya, published by Denpa Publishing. Available now wherever delightful books are sold. We'll be right back after the break with a special interview with Co Ransom.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hello and welcome to Mongasplaining. Listen to me, a occasional feature on the Mongasplaining podcast, where we talk to people that have extra knowledge, let's say specialists, about the manga that we're discussing. As you know, because you've already listened to it, this week we talked about Panpanya and their first English language graphic novel release, An Invitation from a Crab. And we are here today with the translator, and maybe more, of Invitation from a Crab, Co Ransom. Co, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
Happy to have you on board. First up, I know you'll do a better job at this than I will. Can you maybe just give a brief introduction to the our listeners?
Oh, sure. Of myself, correct?
Yeah, of yourself.
Yeah, my name's Co Ransom. I'm a professional translator. I've been at this for around a decade now. I've mostly work on manga, video games, and a little bit of other stuff here and there.
What are some of the titles that you've translated besides Invitation from a Crab that some of our listeners might know?
So some of the bigger ones was working on Attack on Titan, starting with Volume 8, which just wrapped up. I did Prison School.
Some out.
Thank you. It was a lot of work. I worked on Prison School for Yen Press. And in terms of prose, I actually, and the manga as well, I've been working on the Monogatari series for Vertical.
So these are big fan favorite sort of mainstream tentpole type series. And Panpanya and Invitation from a Crab is from a very different place, it feels like. Mm-hmm. It must have been a really different experience for you.
Yeah, in terms of the work itself, I guess, it is a lot more minor than some of the other titles that I've worked on. But in terms of a manga that I read, is actually much closer to my own wheelhouse.
Like your own personal tastes.
Correct, yeah.
So when did you discover Panpanya's work? Was it at Comiket? Did you know about them before they had their like big release?
So yeah, I was going through it trying to pin down the date, and I think it was around the summer of 2010 at Comiket.
Yeah.
And which incidentally I think I met Deb there.
Oh, yeah. pretty fun.
During a Pop Japan travel thing, but because she was there for that. But yeah, I was just really looking around. Comedia is a little bit different from Comiket, where it's all doujinshi, but it's everything's original. There's no kind of parody works of other titles. There's no like fan work. So I was just browsing around, and I happened to pick up a book that interested me, and I started buying At that time, they were in an anthology that a couple of other authors who have gone on to become somewhat well-known as well are in. But
what was the name of that one?
So the name of the group was called SF Kenkyukai, which is kind of translates to kind of a generic like science fiction like research group.
Okay.
And their titles didn't really have anything to do with science fiction, but yeah, from there, basically, I just, you know, I like to go to Comedia a lot. I haven't been able to go as much recently, but back then I went almost every time and always made sure to try to go to Pompano's booth first.
So that's a big deal. I think we've talked a little bit about Comiket and Comitia on the podcast. We covered BL Metamorphosis, which actually sort of dug into going to doujinshi events and things like that, and looking at doujinshi as like a way to sort of break into the industry and tell your own story. So, you know, readers, even like not hardcore readers, might be a little bit familiar with that. But yeah, Comitia is actually my favorite. I like it better than Comiket, just because there's, I mean, we've exhibited, like I've exhibited it so many times. David, who's on the podcast, Deb has been to it. I think even I brought Chip to it maybe even once. So yeah, it's something that people know. And that's actually why I wanted to talk to you specifically about this. Not that it's not nice to just, you know, chat with you, but this work, this type of work, like really independently published doujinshi that doesn't really change from being in doujinshi to being now that Pompano is a professional cartoonist, is not really the narrative that we get about how Japanese manga publishing works. We get this narrative that you're like, you go to doujinshi so that editors at magazines will notice you, so you could work, you know, in Shonen Jump or Afternoon or like one of the big magazines that puts out the hits or whatever. And Pompano's work seems really a lot more personal, a lot more poetic, and it doesn't seem to have changed that much from being doujinshi to now being serialized in these magazines and coming out with these collected editions. But you might have better insight there. Do you feel like their work has changed since you first discovered them in 2010?
Not a whole lot, really. I think, well, especially with a lot of the early volumes, there are a lot of collected doujinshi in here.
Mm-hmm.
In part, like, it's very nice because some of the old doujinshi have kind of ridiculous resale prices, like 10 times, 20 times what they used to sell for. But yeah, I want to say actually when Pompano first got picked up by a publisher, it was, I think in English, it goes by like January and July, the name of the publisher.
Something like that. It's like a small publisher that also does weird anime stuff, right?
Yeah, and it was a more kind of BL focused book they're putting out. And I think they went from there to Hakusensha now.
Mm-hmm.
But I can't say that like they've changed all too much. The art style has changed a little bit over the years, but that's like maybe the main thing.
It's funny that you mentioned that they're at Hakusensha now, because I actually went and checked out the Hakusensha online magazine, which is called Rakuen, where their work runs. And it's like a women's manga, not a, like kind of Jose Seinen, like general women's manga kind of stuff. And it literally looks just like commercial Jose, commercial shoujo almost. And so you get all these like pages of like, you know, just women characters, beautiful big eyes, like the whole thing, everything you think of when you think of like manga for women and girls. And then Pantania is like weird little scribbly self-contained like self character in the middle of this like huge spread. And I'll put these in the show notes so folks can see what I'm saying, but it's like it just seems crazy to me that this artist that started out as this like super idiosyncratic, very personal art style and very personal stories has turned into someone that's made a career in mainstream manga. I wonder, like, I don't know that there's a question here other than just befuddlement. And I was wondering if you had any thoughts about that as well.
Yeah, I'm not too sure about if there's any sort of like inherent demographic overlap or anything, but I think, you know, as I was going to Pompano's booth over, you know, successive comedias, you would see like the line get bigger and bigger and bigger. And it did seem like, you know, there was something very, you know, a lot of people almost instantly recognized just how good of a creator they are. Which, and being at Comedia, that probably would naturally attract the eyes of some editors. Maybe you've talked about it before, but, you know, a lot of editorial departments are set up at Comedia and in part just doing, like, taking walk-ins, but I assume they also look around the floor as well.
Yeah, when they have time. Some of the editors that I know through, you know, TCAF work and other stuff would say, oh, I'm going to go to try and get to Comedia today. So, like, they would actually say that because they were going to try and drop by my booth just to say hi, which is, like, really nice of them when they're, like, coming to a comics event on their half a day off they probably get, you know, as manga editors.
Yeah.
And, yeah, scouting the floor to see if there was anything interesting. So, yeah, it was a delight when I sort of discovered this work after, like, honestly, after it had been translated. And it was because, you know, I was excited about it because you had talked it up to me. I don't know if you remember, but, you know, sort of after it had been announced or licensed, you were like, oh my goodness, that, you know, I'm so excited about this one. Did you want Panpanya to be translated in English? Was that a concern of yours when you were buying their doujinshi? Was it something that you considered?
It wasn't really at the top of my mind, I guess, especially just in terms of there are those questions of, like, commercial viability in America, and but, you know, 2010 was a very different place in terms of the market than 2021. Yeah, and there are people who are also kind of picking up some of the shorter stories and putting them online in English as well, and I think that might have made a little bit of an audience, so I'm not sure. Sense.
So, wait, was it you then? Like, I think we talked about this, but again, I think we were having beers maybe, and it was also 2.5 to 3 years ago. Was it you that introduced Denpa's publisher, Ed Chavez, to Pampanya's work?
I'm not sure if I would be the first, but I'm sure I talked to Zeroff about them. So, yeah.
Oh, that's great. And, like, and then obviously it sort of came to, I mean, I would assume that if Ed knew how much you liked Pampanya's work, that he would come to you first and be like, do you want to translate this? But I mean, was there any kind of campaigning involved to make sure that you got the translation job for that one?
Not really. I generally don't do that unless it's, yeah, I actually rarely campaign. I just want to see, you know, good work get put out.
Well, I'm glad that you got to do it, because I knew what such a fan, you know, you were of it. But reading Invitation from a Crab, the big thing for me is that it's clear that the author is, like, not overly concerned with traditional narrative, I guess is a way to put it. I feel like some of the stories, especially in Invitation from a Crab, and I don't know, I assume this carries throughout the rest of their work, they are, like, often barely stories. Like, they're occasionally poetic, they're short sketches, sometimes one pagers, they're jokes, they're myths, they're dreams, they're memories. I can only imagine, like, I would feel like that would make it difficult to translate because it's so ethereal so much of the time. Did you find that with the work, or was it just, you know, another day in the translation minds for you?
I don't know. Maybe my familiarity with so much of the work helped a lot, because, as you said, there is a lot of, like, this kind of, like, this overall mood in the different stories. So, yeah, I guess that helped a lot with kind of, you know, word choice and phrasing and the overall English mood of it.
I feel like if this was coming out now and I was marketing this book, I would describe Panpanya as a vibe rather than as a manga graphic novel. Like, you're just kind of in their space. And, you know, we're recording this interview, even though it's going to run later in the episode, it's before I've had a chance to talk to any of the other hosts to see what they thought of this volume. But I could see, like, bouncing off this super hard, or I could see this being your favorite manga of all time. And I feel like there's not a lot of middle ground for that. And, like, clearly you love it, but, like, was that something that you were aware of? That, like, are you, did when you were translating it, did you try and localize it in any way to make it more appealing to a North American demographic?
Not particularly. And I think it's kind of, you know, a lot of the art kind of speaks for itself as well, and the overall structure of the story is, so I guess for me personally, like, one of the things that I love most about their work is a lot of the short ones is, you know, kind of like a really good short story. The endings are always, like, they really hit hard, or, like, they might, like, leave you with a very strong, like I guess a strong emotional response, maybe not in one direction or another, but it just kind of, like, sits with you.
Yeah.
So I guess that might have been something that I was especially aware of.
I want to talk about the art a little bit, because that's the thing that I find myself really sort of reflecting on and thinking a lot about. Like, it's clear, like, you pick up this volume and just a couple pages in, it's clear that the artist is not working in sort of a finalized sharp ink style. You know what I mean? With like zip tones or digital zip tones or whatever. I think I counted, you know, ink and screen tone, but also a little bit of digital work. And then traditional, there's pencil, there's watercolor, there's marker, and there might even be like there's photography in the end papers and things like that. You know, is that, it's always weird because it's something that immediately sets itself apart from like 99% of manga that's published. Like manga is just this like kind of means just one thing in North America. And then you get something that is clearly manga, but also often its own little world. Is that something that made it attractive for you? Is that something that you really considered when you were translating as well, that there's all these different parts to it, I guess?
In terms of the art, I mean, it is kind of an art style that I'm pretty fond of. Like I'm a huge sucker for, you know, cross-hatching everywhere. In terms of, I guess, the variety of materials and how it kind of came out in the translation, I mean, that's a bit of a hard thing to kind of, you know, consciously put into a translation, I suppose. But there is always this kind of, even in the some of the doujinshi that they put out, there's a very handcrafted feel to it. Some of them were like hand-bound, and that is partially why they're so expensive now, but you know, just even the materials, the books, some of the original doujinshi came in are very, you know, kind of rough and idiosyncratic.
Even this volume, noticing, I guess the lead character is talking to the painter about the ducks and how like the ducks are all done in a painterly style in a way that isn't trying to draw attention to itself. I feel a lot of comics when they're doing mixed media start to become about the mixed media rather than sort of serving the storytelling. And I don't get that sense a lot of the time from Campagna's work, which is really interesting. I would love to see those original doujinshi too, because work that's reproducible is often very, very different than work that is handcrafted and whatnot. Not everything photocopies or scans well, you know?
Yeah. There's a little 2-page spread at the very end of the English version that says promotional book cover in the bottom right.
Okay.
And that is actually, I think when Invitation from a Crab first came out in Japan, at one of Pampania's last Commedia appearances, they were doing kind of brown paper book covers that they were giving away. Cool. And they were signing copies as well. So I managed to get one of those and I sent it over to Ed when he was asking about bonuses. And that's why it got added to the book. And I think also if you buy it at conventions, you can sometimes get kind of like an English reproduction of it.
Oh, wow. Okay. I've got the digital edition of it. Actually, not the digital edition, but a review copy for Pampania's Invitation from Crab has been provided by Denpa Publishing for review. That book cover is at the back with the sort of crab and Pampania sitting on the couch, and it's really cool. And so they're actually reproducing that at comic events sometimes? That's actually really neat.
I believe so, yeah.
Oh, very cool. But I would love to know, are there other mangaka that you feel have a similar vibe to Pampania that fans that really dig this might want to search out, either in Japanese or in English, if you know?
Sure. One author that I'll always bring up, but this is partially because I think about this author too much as well, is Tsuge Yoshiharu. Especially his, you know, his work in the 60s and 70s, which, you know, thanks to Ryan Holmberg, and is a lot of that's becoming much more available in America, which is, you know, wonderful.
Tsuge, by the way, is currently being published by Drawn and Quarterly and New York Review of Books, putting out that period of material in really nice hardcovers, or some of them are hardcovers, some are soft covers, and that's available in French and things as well for our international listeners. Definitely check it out.
Yeah. And in terms of, I guess there are a lot of kind of common or like points of connection in Glacier Bay's Glalieola anthology, which I know is fairly limited print run. You know, a lot of people who are originally from doujinshi themselves or other very like super indie backgrounds, and a lot of shorter works that are all really good.
We haven't really talked a lot about alternative manga on the podcast. This is kind of our first official alternative manga, but we have sort of veered to the edge, let's say, of the alternative end of commercial comics. And it really is like a pretty big jump and a leap. And I think that's really interesting. So I think maybe at the end of this episode, we'll put some links to not only Glaliola, Glaliola 1 is sold out, but Glaliola 2 is still available from Glacier Bay, as well as a bunch of other shorts. But there is some other really interesting work coming out from small publishers that if you liked this, I'll put some links at the bottom, at the end of the show notes as well. Yeah, that's great. That's a great recommendation.
Oh, and one more, if you don't mind.
Go ahead, go ahead.
Obviously, there's Guiavano Holiday coming out, but also by Pompagno from Dempa pretty soon. So there's more on the way.
Sorry, I didn't know that there was a second Pompagno book coming out.
Oh, yeah. It's a long form travelogue.
Oh, wow. I love travelogues in comics form. That is coming in December from Dempa. That's awesome. And you translated that one as well?
Yes, I did.
Oh, very good. I'm excited. I had no idea that was coming. Yeah. And so now there's like, we just finished this and we're going to get another book. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I want to actually just talk about the Japanese-ness of this book. Mm. The work to me has a feeling of being in a dimension that is maybe just shifted two or three steps away from our own. And I started the book thinking of it as fantasy, as like magical realism as whatever, until she gets on like a real train line or stops at a real train station or sees JR, you know, Japan Railway signs in the background, sometimes little like names and things like that. Like my friend lives at Yoga Station, which she gets off at for This Is Hell. Mm-hmm. I mean, that area seems nice. I don't know why it would be helpful for them, but what do you think of these settings? Like even by the end with the carp streamer story, the author makes pains at the beginning of that story to say this one really just happened, which retroactively kind of unsettles the previous stories that are in the book. But I feel like it's all at least informed by their life and their wanderings and their musings and things like that. But it's also so far removed in some ways that it's difficult. Like, is this Japan? Is this meant to be like, is this meant to evoke contemporary Japan? Is it meant to be somewhere else? What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it does feel like a contemporary Japan, but in the parts that are kind of on the edges, kind of like just maybe East Tokyo, right, as you're starting to kind of get away from the city where everything's a little old, a lot of things are shut down. Mm. I think they even wrote a little essay manga about like the various soft serve ice creams you can get around, where is it, Tokyo Skytree. Used to be a very old neighborhood until they just kind of plopped the giant sky tree down there. So that's also a weird neighborhood if you kind of, you know, get out about just 10 minutes.
Mm.
And that's kind of what a lot of the work evokes for me the most.
That's like the old Edo, right? Like that's where the city center used to be, right around the water there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I feel like you can really feel the age of everything in their work.
Yeah.
But I don't get a sense of New Tokyo, of like, you know, Shinjuku, Ikebukuro, Shibuya, that side of things almost at all.
Yeah, definitely.
It feels very different, I guess. I do think that it's interesting. Well, so for example, another example is they go to Ginza, and Ginza is like an emotional idea of Ginza rather than a real place, but also Ginza is a real place. Like we've both been. So I find it really interesting. I don't know how someone, and I guess I will know by the time this comes out, cause we'll have just talked about it, how someone from not Japan registers these ideas of place and time and of how people interact and how some people are just, you know, animals or whatnot. Do you have any insight there that you want to add? Like, is there a tradition of this in manga and doujinshi that like we're not aware of, or something just to illuminate it for, I think, readers who might be confused by, you know, some folks are yokai, for example.
Oh yeah. I'm not even sure if there's too much of a history of this behind it, but yeah, it was more of just kind of like a mood or a vibe to me, I guess.
There you go. Okay. Well, that is awesome. And I really appreciate you offering this sort of insight into Pompagno, into Invitation from a Crab. I think it is a book that sort of opens up a whole new world of manga for people that have been following the podcast. And that's why I actually really wanted to talk to you, to just like let people know that there was more out there. And hopefully we'll be able to cover it if Chip lets us pick it in the future. So anything you would like to add? Where can people find you online or anything like that? Are you good being a digital nomad?
Yeah, mostly you can find me on Twitter posting nonsense at K Ransom Was Taken. I guess the other thing I wanted to say is I also wanted to shout out Nicole, who was the producer and letterer on this. I think she did a really great job.
Personally, I think the book looks great. So I'm so, yeah, shout out to Nicole and shout out to, sorry, there's like a whole credits. We'll shout them out at the beginning episode, I promise.
Okay.
But yeah, that's awesome. Well, Ko, thanks so much for spending some time with us today. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks again for having me.
And we're back. Once again, we'd like to thank Ko Ransom for agreeing to do that interview with us. Hopefully it enlightened as much as it educated y'all listening as much as it did me. We are here with Q&As, actually. We have a bit of a small Q, but maybe some big A's on this one.
Wait a minute. I think you have to do that again.
Mark this podcast explicit. Question comes in email from Eric Schuster. Eric writes, anecdotes about mangaka working insane schedules are common, but in light of seeing Shibashi Hiroshi's insane schedule and reading those depressing excerpts from Kawaruchi Miura's diary, I'm curious, is the profession considered especially masochistic within Japanese culture? Is it considered a lucrative career? It seems like there's more room for artists to have success just because the industry is larger, but I'd value some insights from people who know more about both Japanese culture and their comics industry. And I wanted to ask this one because we haven't tackled Berserk yet. I know a lot of people are asking us to read it, and it's just like, you know, doing a Berserk episode just after the mangaka passes away seems not cool. So maybe we'll get to it at some point in the future. But the underlying episodes, the underlying things that people are curious about there is like the overwork culture in manga. And I don't know that any of us are necessarily experts to talk about overwork culture in Japan in general. There are lots of articles written about that online. But within the manga industry, I think we could definitely open up this question. So yeah, is being a mangaka considered a lucrative career? And is it considered especially masochistic in Japanese culture? Did you guys have any thoughts?
I can't comment on the Japanese culture part, but I feel like any job that makes you work like 150 hours a week is masochistic by definition, you know?
Yeah.
Ouch.
Like, you know, I'm sure like many people are probably well compensated, but that's probably like the very tip top of the pecking order, for lack of a better phrase. But I think anything that like requires you to break your body and like mess up your relationships just by virtue of doing the work, and that not being kind of a guaranteed living wage, is, it could use work, let's say.
Yeah.
is there anything in, like, is that, I know you said you can't speak to the Japanese culture part of it, but does it feel like it's prevalent in Japanese culture, like not just in manga, to like devote your mind and body to a thing to a point where it might be unhealthy?
The thing that people throw out when they write articles about this is Japan has a word, Japanese language has a word for death by overworking.
Karoshi.
And it's called karoshi. And it's a word that, you know, like if that word has to exist, you know, there's a chance that there might be something there.
Yeah.
You know, and I look at it, you know, I'm someone who devoted way too much time to the work that I was doing for a long time. And I eventually broke. Like I just broke. It was bad. And I, you know, I took the last year off basically trying to put that together. But no one forced me to do that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I forced me to do that. I forced me to like work and work and work and contribute to something that meant a lot to me. And I feel like manga does the same thing. It's comics, man. Like, I think anyone who works in comics, in any kind of facility of comics, any part of comics, knows that you can literally devote unlimited time. Like, you can just keep working on your comics all the time. And that's any level. Like, I did social media for a long time, and there's never an end to the number of Twitter posts you can make, or prepping, you know, social media posts on Instagram or whatever. There's never an end to any of it. You can just work indefinitely. And I think the only difference that I see between manga and North American comics is manga romanticizes that journey. There are so many manga that romanticize being a mangaka. I think the biggest one is probably Bakuman. That was the most popular. It had the widest range. It had an anime adaptation. It's about two guys that, like, you know, want to break into Shonen Jump so bad that like one of them works himself into the hospital, for example, but he gets out and then they get number one. So it's okay. Right. So I think that there's definitely a culture. There's an expectation that you're going to work very, very hard if you go into manga. And it's something that a lot of people do, but it's also something a lot of people opt out of as well at certain points in their career.
But that's true of a lot of comics in general, right? I mean, there aren't that many. I often hear people talk about comics, both American, French, Japanese, as a young person's game, where you have the energy and the will and basically the bounce back to do a bunch of all nighters, and you have like this burning drive to do it, and you also maybe have a little less responsibilities, right? So it's something that you can go chase that dream. I think the part that is hard is like when you get older and you're not one of those top artists and you can't afford to get assistance and your work is considered old fashioned or not hip anymore. That's pretty depressing, I think. And I feel like sometimes with manga is a little bit like the NBA. You know, like everybody wants to be a top star. Very few are multimillionaire level top stars. Yeah. There are people who make it to the pros and they get to play on the court, but they're not superstars. But that's still a level that a lot of people will never reach.
Yeah, it's like the NBA. If there was the NBA and then a league just below the NBA that was 500 times bigger, with 500 times more players that were all earning just enough to get by for those limited years you can play basketball. That's how comics feels.
Wow. Ouch.
Oh, God.
The basketball comparison is really good because, like, we just had the Olympics and, like, NBA finals and stuff. And old in basketball, like, once you're 35, you're over the hill. Like, they're like, your knees are bad, this and that. And it sometimes feels, people talk about comics the same way. Like, if you don't get in your 20s, like, you're super screwed. But hopefully that's not necessarily true.
I mean, but people also throw out the fact that Jack Kirby didn't draw Fantastic Four issue 1 until he was like 40 or something.
Yeah,
like,
true.
Like, I mean, it's the exception that proves the rule, because I don't think there's a lot of that happening these days. It depends on your style as well, and what's expected of a comic artist now seems to be a lot more than it was in the 50s and 60s. I've said it before on this podcast that drawing comics is literally the hardest art job I can imagine. Having done a bunch of different art jobs before I did comics, like, it's a combination of every art skill that you pick up from everywhere else, and you have to do it as quickly as possible
and get second guessed a lot.
It's a ludicrous idea to think you can make a living as a comic book artist.
I don't think it's as bad as people think it is for in Japan. Like, I think we tend to look at what Tezuka went through, and we tend to look at the stories of the people just like frantic and trying to crank out on a weekly schedule. But I don't think a lot of manga artists do weekly manga.
Yeah. There are fewer weekly magazines than there used to be, for sure. But that just means there's less opportunity to get paid every week. You know what I mean? But I think, I know that there are people. So I got a couple anecdotes. One, I met somebody who didn't want to break in, who was an assistant, and they didn't want to break in because being an assistant, you just did less work. No matter what, you did less work.
Yeah.
So you got a consistent paycheck. It didn't matter how well your manga sold, which means you maybe get like a year end bonus, but you always had, like, if you were really good at drawing a specific thing, like a kind of background or inking or, you know, spotting blacks or laying down tone, you'd always have work, and the work would always be the same. It'd be in your wheelhouse. So it's like almost like a factory job, you know, with some lovely artistic flourishes. You could clock in, clock out and go home and then have time off. Tatsumi Sensei, who did Abandon the Old in Tokyo and the Pushman and things like that, was told by his doctors to stop drawing because he was ill and he couldn't. He literally couldn't. He had his wife bring him a board and paper in the hospital and was drawing in the hospital before he passed away because drawing was so important to him, hunched over with back problems. Kishimoto Sensei, who did Naruto, interviewed him about the end of it. And he's like, he bought his studio. This is funny. His studio, where he has all his assistants and things like that, was in the same building as his apartment with his wife and his two kids, so that his wife and his two kids could come up and talk to him if they needed to for something, because he would have to be in the studio for like 15 hours, 16 hours. And he just figured out how to make this insane schedule work where he could still have proximity to his kids. But he was happy to give that up when Naruto's serialization ended. And I think he moved to a much more, you know, he hit the jackpot and could really pull back and work at a different kind of pace with Boruto and as the writer, and then the movies and the novels and things like that. And finally, there's a book coming out that I got to edit, and it's called Akira Art of Wall. I think I might have mentioned it.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. At the Akira Volume 2 episode.
Very and, smooth flex.
There's a thing in there where Otomo is just like, yeah, pimping the book. David, I don't know why you don't pimp more of your books on here. Everyone go buy this $250 book that I edited.
Wait, is that how much it costs?
It is gorgeous. It is worth every penny. I'm not even lying.
I can't afford it. I'm a comic book artist.
It's 22 by 30. It's like huge. It's like 11 by 17, and it's like a never-ending scroll of artwork. it's really pretty. But beyond that, there's an interview in there. And Otomo's like, yeah, I never did any long series after Akira. I didn't want to draw manga that way. I'll draw stuff every once in a while and it's for fun. But like having a deadline like that sucked. I never want that. All those old guys that, and he was very matter of fact, he's like, all those old guys that were like, oh, I'm putting out 500 pages a month or 600 pages a month, 700 a month. They're dead. They died early. Who wants that? I don't want that. And like, it's a good interview. It's really wide ranging about Otomo's life and his career or whatever. But you like, oh, there's a generation of people that like maybe get it. I know Matsumoto Sensei, who's become a friend, Taiyo Matsumoto, has slowed down a lot as he's gotten older. He doesn't want to do a weekly series anymore and work with 10 assistants and crack it out. Dude's in his like late 40s, early 50s maybe now. He maybe just wants to like draw things that matter to him, and he can. And that's the other nice thing. You can get to do that if you get to a certain point. So. Yeah, I think there's lots of different ways to approach this idea of working in comics, but the way that is like the way that is like shown and like the path that exists is really tough. And everyone goes into it knowing that. No one gets into manga and is like, oh, I didn't think it would be this hard. Like everyone, it is drilled into you that it's going to be a brutal mercenary slog. And maybe the reward is you get to tell stories that are important to you.
In a personal, not anecdote, but I've recently come to the decision that I'm done in 2 years' time. Like I've mapped out how I'm going to get out of doing the monthly comics because I recognize it's killing me. Mm-hmm. My blood pressure's high and I've got various health issues. And I'm just like, gee, I wonder if it is the 12-hour work days every day, including the weekends. Yeah. And so like I've got commitments. I'm just like, what am I doing? My big question for myself is like, what do you want to do with the rest of your life? And I can entertain people doing Spider-Man comics, and that's fine. And hey, maybe I'll renege on this, and that's what I'll end up doing. Or I can just do stuff that is personal to me, and maybe some people like it, maybe some people don't. And if I can get to a point where I just need to make enough money to kind of like cover my groceries and stuff, like my loving partner is going to have to understand that that's all I'm going to be able to pull in because I chose a career in comics and I've killed my body and that's that. Sorry.
Yeah.
So I get
that kind
it.
Of sustainability is really important. I think like it always sounds sad to say like set your expectations. It's like, oh, you know, don't aim for the very top, aim for like the middle, but like the middle is kind of where most of us land anyway, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. And you can make a very nice life. Like if you're just like, look, I don't necessarily want a Porsche. I just want a car I can be proud of. And you can find something that works for your budget and your lifestyle. And if you don't want to draw and write monthly comics, you can, you know, switch to graphic novels or web comics or something like that. Like there's always options. It's just those options might not have the same, you know, pros or cons as like Big Two work or like Shonen Jump or something like that.
Yeah. That's funny. The Porsche thing also was like, for the most part, people that get the Porsche do it because they want the status symbol of it. It's not because, oh, no, I need a car that's a lot better than my current car, so I'm going to get a Porsche.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like that's the thing I think a lot of artists here and abroad probably wrestle with, too, which is, like, the ego behind it all and, like, what they want to show the world. And, like, I know comic creators just get, like, furious to be number two in the charts on a week.
What?
Any given week. Mm-hmm. But that's part of it. That's part of what drives them to be like the best they can be. But I'm like, well, that's also a miserable existence. Like, why would you want to do that?
Those charts are so arbitrary too.
it doesn't matter. Somebody finds out somebody's making more money than them, has a better gig than them, you know, has the top selling comic of the month. Like there are just people that like are just driven by competition, jealousy, and ego, and they're killing themselves.
Say Michael Jordan. We all know what we're talking about.
That happens in Japan too. That happens with manga, absolutely. Like, to bring it back to this question, absolutely. It's like, yeah, there are people push themselves for sure.
Yeah.
People push themselves for sure in a way that isn't healthy, but they want the brass ring, right?
Like, David, you're a Charles Schulz fan as well, yeah. Right? Like, yeah. The stories of him and Jim Davis, like Charles Schulz, like losing his mind that Jim Davis like got like
it a sounds Garfield so endorsement out of character. Deal.
It does, because, you know, especially yeah. based on the public appearance and the work and the tone of the work, but there's an insecurity in the work too that you can see that must exist within the creator.
Mm-hmm.
And like just the idea, you just picture like Charles Schulz being like, God damn, Jim Davis got that deal for like Garfield Doritos or whatever. Like, that's really, really funny to me. And also just like, wow, at every level, it hits you.
I will say the one thing I maybe we didn't answer here is that there is a mid range. There is a mid level as a mangaka that you can hit and have a living wage. And I feel like that level where you have to get in North American comics is a lot higher to get that living wage and to get that ongoing living wage than it is in Japan. Like, you can have a mid range serial or three or four different serials over the course of your career and still make a life for yourself. Mm-hmm. You're not going to live that like ego, you know, I'm buying a new McLaren, you know, YouTube family lifestyle shit, but you're not also like struggling either. And that's the other sin of Bakuman. I'm just going in on Bakuman this week, but like, it starts off by saying, oh, my uncle had like a hit series and he had toys and he had whatever and whatever. And then he died penniless and broke. And it's like, that has nothing to do with like, because he didn't like get a number one Shonen Jump series and he just had a good series. It had to do with maybe like that character or that person's life. You know what I mean? Like, there are lots of people that make a living in manga, and then they diversify and they do all kinds of different stuff. They have art shows, they sell their originals, they like, you know, continue to find serialization where they can, they go to North America and do variant covers or whatever. Like, there's not one path anymore for manga, and I think people are slowly starting to figure that out, and that grind is going. But the other half of that is that, like, the pressure, like, maybe Chip, you can answer this, don't you feel Miura sensei who did Berserk, like, those fans were chomping at the bit for every new chapter. Every time there was a delay, every time a chapter took too long, every time it was a short chapter, like, there was enormous pressure on him to have output. You know what I mean? Like, I feel like that's a big part of the equation, is like how we as people who consume manga or comics treat the people who make it.
I mean, I think in North American comics, you don't get that much with the DC Marvel system, because you're on the schedule that they set out for you. And, you know, maybe with the exception of Hawkeye, when Fraction was doing Hawkeye with David and Annie, because that was so late at some point, but Marvel had no choice in the matter, like, because they had to keep that team on it. You can't do a bunch of fill-in issues or fire them from Hawkeye, because it's like their top selling book. Mm-hmm. That was a case where there was a lot of fan pressure, but like, rarely does that happen in Marvel DC. And over on the more independent side, all I can think of is Saga with Brian and Fiona, and how, you know, fans are just like constantly barraging them, like, when is it coming back? When is it coming back? But you don't tend to get that. People just tend to forget. Like, they'll be upset the first month or two when something doesn't come out, and then they just forget. And then that feels even worse as a creator, because you're like, oh, okay, well, I guess that's that.
There's that anecdote that no one remembers that it took a year for Watchmen 12 to come out after Watchmen 11 came out. They just remember that the graphic novel sold like 250 million copies or something.
Yeah, that's so, its own thing, though.
Yeah, Watchmen is very much its own thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I hope, Eric, that answered some of your questions about manga. we went pretty broad there, but I think some of it was really good.
It's a question and almost and answer.
Yeah, we went very broad there, and I went very specific with my life.
Well, we love you for that.
I don't know this for a fact, but maybe, Chris, you do. But is it more possible to live a decent middle-class life as a moderately popular manga artist than it is as a moderately popular U.S. comics artist?
Yes. You can do it as a manga artist even if your partner doesn't work. But in North America, generally, most of the moderately successful comic artists that are getting by are doing so because they have a partner who works.
I mean, that also goes for illustration here as well. I think they're kind of the same thing. I may have told this anecdote before on the podcast, but in my first year out of illustration school, myself and my buddy who graduated went back to the school to give a lecture to the class about what it's like to be out of school for a year, mostly to counter just like the older illustrators coming in and giving information that was useless to us.
Yeah.
And so we went in and we did like a slideshow of like kind of the work we produced that year for various magazines and newspapers. But also one of the slides was how we were able to be illustrators. The slide was photos of both of our spouses with the dollar amount that they made at their job individually. Nice. And we were just like, that is their take-home pay. It's not a lot, but it's enough that we can do this stupid job that pulls in less than them. Like, like to survive as an illustrator, you really need a supportive partner. And I think in comics, it's like that too, because of the there's no such thing as a consistent income. Like it varies wildly. Like I'll have some months where I'm like, oh, I've made $0. Like literally months where I'm just like, oh, my bank account received $0 this month. But it's just because of timing and like maybe, you know, something wrapped up and I just started a thing and I'm not going to get paid for that for a while. And like a bunch of things kind of backed up. I could have some months that are great and some months that are just terrible. And same with the years. And that's a very hard way to live a life, freelance anything. So to have a partner that has a steady income, I think most comic book artists probably have that.
The other thing I want to mention is health insurance, is that both Canada and Japan have health insurance. And that is like government provided for the most part health insurance with some notable gaps, like, you know, no cap, but America doesn't. And that makes it even harder for people working in the US in the comics industry to not have nationalized healthcare. That's like a huge thing that Japan has an advantage there where you can earn a little bit less because you don't have to worry about a health emergency.
Sorry, Deb. Sorry, David.
Sorry, Deb. Sorry, David.
What can you do? My plan is to marry rich anyway, so.
Ah, see, there you go.
Yeah.
I got no plans. The cat definitely ain't pulling his weight.
cat modeling?
He did cat modeling? He did catch three mice in the last week, though, so he's trying.
There you go. That's great.
Instagram? Instagram? All right. Eric, sorry to end on a bit of a downer note there, but you got more than you bargained for. Thanks for emailing us. If you want to email us a question for Mogsplaining Q&A, we are contact at mogsplaining.com, or you just visit mogsplaining.com, click on the email link. That'll connect us. Or you can just do it on Twitter or Instagram or Facebook or wherever we are. You can just message us. Why not? All right. This has been an episode, man. This has been an episode of Mogsplaining.
Mogsplaining. Why not?
Why not? What? We are here anyway. Why not? Thank you so much for listening. Thanks to my delightful co-hosts as always. And we will see you next week for Blank Canvas. Thanks very much. This has been Mongasplaining Season 2, Episode 4, An Invitation from a Crab by Pon Panya. Thanks so much for listening. For our next episode, we'll be discussing the manga Blank Canvas by Akiko Higashimura. Want to pick up a copy? Consider supporting your local comic and manga specialty shop. You can find one near you at comicshoplocator.com. Also, check your local library. You never know. You can also follow along with our complete reading list at mongasplaining.com. We'd like to thank DADS for their musical accompaniment this episode.